Well, it took a damaging earthquake and a tidal wave to make many of us aware of it, but it's much more than the wave of Fukushima debris, and it's coming to even our most remote and pristine beaches, marine debris. Good morning, I'm Steve Heimel. Welcome to Talk of Alaska. If it doesn't end up on beaches, that might be even worse. And how do we even begin to tackle our addiction to plastic? Toll free, 1-800-478-8255. 478-TOKA. Local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. Email talk@alaskapublic.org. We're back to the issue of plastic in the ocean today on Talk of Alaska Statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly. If you're not covered by health insurance, you may be eligible for financial help with monthly premiums and out-of-pocket expenses. Open enrollment ends on February 15th. Sign up at healthcare.gov. Last year, 88% of Alaskans who enrolled received financial assistance. Compare plans and see if you qualify for financial assistance. Call 211 to get free local help. Visit getcoveredalaska.org for more information. This message sponsored by Ashna, a partner of Get Covered Alaska. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Well, here we are. We've got a great panel for you, and we're open for your calls at 1-800-478-8255. If you're in Anchorage, it's a local call at 550-8422. The issue is marine debris. And with us we have, by digital link from NPR in Washington, D.C., Nicole Trenholm of the Ocean Research Project. Nicole, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Steve.
We're glad to have you here. And, of course, you will be a keynote speaker at the Alaska Forum on the Environment next Monday. So you will be actually coming here, and you'll be talking, I guess, about marine debris. Maybe you can give me some idea of what that talk is going to be.
Sure. Well, essentially, we're going to be discussing the monitoring efforts that the Ocean Research Project has been involved with over the past couple of years. I'm also going to be discussing some of the partnerships that we have developed in order to analyze the marine debris data that we've collected. And I'm also going to discuss a little bit about some of the recovery and prevention projects that we're keen on getting involved with.
Yeah, and you've already been in touch with our other guest in the studio, Chris Pallister of Gulf of Alaska Keeper, I understand. Is that right?
That's correct.
And Chris, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Now, thanks for having me, Steve.
So you're based out of Whittier, more or less?
Well, we're based out of Anchorage, but we operate out of Whittier and Seward and Homer, both, all three of them.
I'm glad you could get in here, and I know you are in the midst of a recovery project. Because we talked about it before on the show. And essentially what we discovered was that there are certain beaches in Alaska where plastic debris shows up, and it doesn't have to be from Japan.
Correct.
And so there are spots now where there's colossal amounts of this stuff that's been gathered up, sometimes by locals.
Yeah, there's the tremendous amount of trash. Some of our outer coastline beaches that are hard on the Gulf of Alaska have as much as 30 tons of plastic debris per mile, which is an astounding amount of plastic.
30 tons per mile.
Correct.
Is there any overall characterization you can say except plastic?
It's vastly...
Wait a minute, some of it's fishing gear.
Yes, and the fishing gear is plastic, too.
Mm-hmm.
And 50% approximately by weight on those outer coastal beaches is old derelict fishing gear, which a lot of it came from foreign fleets and offshore fleets, and it's drifted all the way across the Pacific. And it's 50% by weight, and it's a large part of the volume, too. But there's just untold billions of pieces of everyday consumer plastic on those beaches.
And is there any kind of general thing about how far down it's rendered into microplastics at the point where it hits the beach? I mean, I'm trying to get a fix, basically, on where it's actually going. Because as I understand it, Nicole, your vessels will sail right through the gyre, and you're actually not finding as much plastic as predictions would lead you to believe, meaning that it's gone somewhere.
That's correct, Steve. what we believe is that a lot of the microplastic, it's definitely breaking down. It is collected within these gyres, but eventually it becomes broken down so much to the individual polymer molecules that it ends up becoming part of the ocean chemistry, ingested by all kinds of marine biota, working its way up through the food chain, and eventually also settles at the bottom of the seafloor, becoming a deposit.
And also on the beach, Chris?
We see stuff that ranges from tens of tons, you know, massive trawl nets and big industrial tanks and things like that, all the way down to, you know, you've heard of the famous plastic beach in Hawaii. Well, we have the same situation on beaches on Long Montague.
I've not heard of the famous plastic beach.
You just go out there and the sand is plastic. I mean, it's just a layer of crushed plastic, and we have that same thing on some of our beaches too. So it's,
you're kidding me.
No, I'm not. I could show you photos you wouldn't believe.
Well,
Chris, are you seeing microplastics as well, about 5 millimeters and smaller, the width of your fingernail?
You could find any kind of plastic you want. I mean, we can't clean that up because it's way beyond our scope. But, yeah, it's just a ground-up mess in some places.
Hmm.
We have very high-energy beaches that just churn this stuff up and, you know, grind it into a mush.
Does it tend to get up, go up into the, above the strand line and, you know, into the rocks back, because I've seen pictures of some of these beaches and there'll be tons of driftwood, and then you look down in between the driftwood and whoa.
Yeah, that's true, but the storms are so vicious. We find debris sometimes as much as a half a mile inshore in the forest that the storms have driven it in there. So when we go clean a beach, we aren't restricted right to the strand line. We're way back in the brush picking up trash.
Well, Nicole, tell me a little bit more about how your effort has gone international.
Well, we have partnered with two institutions on our two-year plastic pollution survey. First off, the Five Gyres Institute, who have done surveyed transects through the five gyres of the oceans. They just came out with a published study on what the abundance of plastic is out there. And Dr. Marcus Erickson actually has stated that about 5.25 trillion plastic particles are now currently offshore. And we are, that's an astounding amount. And we also have been in touch with the University of Tokyo's Dr. Takata Shige. He runs the Pellet Watch program, and usually he looks at the pellets that wash up on the beaches and what toxins are absorbed with them, what POPs, persistent organic pollutants. And so he has decided with us that it would be great to look at some of our microplastic samples that we've collected in the North Atlantic Gyre and the North Pacific Gyre to determine and verify the that there is persistent organic pollutants within those samples.
Hmm. So, and this, we probably get into this a little bit more in a little bit, but as I understand it, it's not all that hard for these tiny pieces of plastic to look like something that is good to eat for a bird.
Correct. Sailing through the North Atlantic Gyre and across the Pacific Ocean through the two North Pacific Gyres, when you look over the side, you don't see the microplastics. It's not until you skim a net that and take a look at what you have that you notice tons of microplastics, 5 millimeters and smaller. That has a lot to do with the sea state. But you do still see bottles, a lot of derelict fishing gear, not an island of garbage, just kind of individual pockets of debris that go on by every day.
Okay, we're joined by telephone by Veronica Padula, a graduate student of the University of Alaska Anchorage. Veronica, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Hi, thanks for inviting me to join the conversation.
Well, I'm really happy to talk with you because I was struck, as I think anybody was, by the presentation of your work at the Marine Science Symposium. And I talked to Chris here. He said he already knows you and your work. And as I understand, you're in data gathering at this point, but maybe you can give me some idea just for our listeners as to the nature of your research on the contaminants that these plastics may be giving to these birds?
Sure thing. So this is part of my PhD research that I'm conducting with Doug Causey through UAA. And basically what we are looking at is seabirds that live in the Western Aleutian Islands. So just to kind of give some foundation to where this research started, the Western Aleutian Islands are part of the Arctic, or the Alaska Maritime Refuge, protected by Fish and Wildlife Service. And that part of the world harbors the largest proportion of breeding seabirds in North America. So for me, as a seabird lover, it's kind of a great place to be doing some work. The populations out there are declining, and we really don't know the underlying mechanisms to their decline. So one of the things that I'm interested in looking at is whether or not these birds are being exposed to various contaminants and whether that's impacting their health and sort of their long-term population trends. And so the contaminants that we're most interested in are chemicals called phthalates. And phthalates are plasticizing compounds. So they're not actually molecules that make up a plastic polymer, but they're coated on top of the plastic polymer. And they're rather ubiquitous throughout the environment because they're so heavily used. And they can actually leach off very easily from plastic. So when a bird, say, a plankton-eating bird like an auklet, picks up a small piece of plastic thinking that it's a piece of plankton and gets it into its stomach, all the chemicals that are on the plastic can leach off and get into its system. And it's not just those phthalates. Like was mentioned before, plastics can absorb organic pollutants. So it's almost like this double dose of contaminants the moment a bird ingests one of these pieces of plastic. And we're really concerned because phthalates are a known endocrine disruptor. In other words, that they really interfere with our hormones in our system. And that can have huge impacts on health and development, not only for birds, but for humans as well. There's a real extension in what we do in terms of looking at how phthalates impact human health as well.
And so how do you dig it apart? As I understand, you actually go out on the research vessel, right, the Tikla?
Yes.
And that's a marvelous research opportunity, fieldwork opportunity for scientists to go out in Alaska Maritime Wildlife Refuge on that research boat.
And, no kidding.
Awesome. And Doug Causey, your professor that you're working with there, brought some really striking pictures back about just how pervasive the plastic is out there. Mm-hmm. And particularly with relation to birds. I mean, a lot of people by this time have probably seen these iconic pictures of dead birds that are opened up and their guts are completely full of plastic. And he was showing that, from Alaska Maritime, right out there in the Aleutians.
Right. Well, actually, the tricky thing about our birds, so a lot of sort of those iconic pictures come from the albatross that breed in Hawaii, because they're foraging basically right in the gyre. And the tricky thing about our birds is that it actually doesn't necessarily look like that. These birds kind of look healthy from the outside, but they're still ingesting particles of plastic. However, they're so small that it's not necessarily causing starvation. They're causing the sequestration of contaminants in their tissues that could have, way, way more impact in terms of their long-term health than this, very acute effect of starvation.
Mm. And then, as I understand it, even the eggs, you get down to the eggs, and there can be huge contaminant loads in eggs that are actually toxic. An egg, mm-hmm. The egg then would never probably actually produce a chick. But that doesn't mean it's not an egg that a subsistence gatherer might find.
Right, and so our.
And
our
I don't mean to spread. I don't mean to spread.
The beginning of all of this.
Yeah, I don't mean to spread alarm because we're just guessing here. But the fact of the matter is, you can get concentration in those eggs, right?
Yes, and so just to clarify on our embryonic tissue. So we collect birds when we go out there, and we dissect them when we come home. We're using all parts of the bird to analyze for contaminants, because this research is sort of so much in its beginning stages, we don't know where these contaminants end up. And what happened in 2013 is we actually collected three female birds that hadn't yet laid their eggs. And so we had this embryonic tissue that hadn't seen the light of day. Anything that was in that embryonic tissue was coming from the mother. And so we were able to detect phthalates in these embryonic tissues. And we don't know, you know, because we were collecting the birds and it was, you know, lethal collection, we don't know if that egg would have ever survived to being a chick. And we're really interested in doing more long-term studies and seeing if survivorship is impacted by levels of contaminants in these eggs. But it really raises the question of what happens as this egg develops if it's already exposed to chemicals that really mess with hormones, which are such a big part of development, right? And on top of that, by extension, there are people who eat these eggs. And what happens to them when they're ingesting eggs that could potentially have these harmful chemicals in them? There are lots of questions raised by, you know, these preliminary data that we're collecting.
And right now, essentially, you've got a bunch of samples, and they're in the freezer, and they're awaiting a tedious laboratory analysis.
Actually, we should be getting some data back this week. We are really lucky because at UAA, we collaborate with the Asset Lab, the Applied Science and Engineering Technology Lab, and without them, you know, this work wouldn't really be possible. And so we've been working with professors in the UAA chemistry department to get this work off the ground, and we should hopefully have new data back this week, and hopefully we can continue analyzing more samples. It is a very long and involved process to get to that data point, especially when you consider that plastic is everywhere and the analysis has to be as plastic-free as possible.
Yeah. Do you have any questions for Veronica here, Nicole?
Sure. To what degree do you guys look at excrement of the seabirds for POPs? Yeah.
We haven't actually examined that. When we dissect our birds, we actually put their intestines aside for a different project. So and they're looking at microbial diversity. So we haven't examined the excrement. We do look at their stomach contents. That's kind of where we focus. And we will take anything inside their stomach and sort of brush it out of the stomach and do a density separation analysis, which is really easy. It's basically put everything inside the stomach in a beaker of water and look for what floats, because essentially what floats is probably going to be made of plastic.
Hmm.
Certainly. Well, the only reason I said anything is because it might have been a missed opportunity in collecting samples of bird feces. I spent a lot of time scrubbing those decks each morning. We had birds visiting all the time crossing the ocean. So,
good
point.
Well,
we're going out again this summer, so and we'll be collecting more samples. There's always an opportunity to rethink how we dissect and sample our birds. So that's a good idea.
Yeah, actually, I like that. You find some graduate student, right, and you put him in charge of the guano gathering.
Yeah, I get all the fun jobs.
I'm really enjoying this. This is almost as good as when we had Mark Nelson on talking about the feces sphere. But we haven't managed to float as a scientific concept yet, but we keep trying. All right. Well, glad to hear those chuckles anyway. So before we go to Kathy and Craig, who I know is going to be a lot of fun, I want to touch back with you, Chris Pallister of Gulf of Alaska Keeper, because you said you want to do the same thing with fish that Veronica is doing to birds.
Actually, we've been doing the same thing with fish for several years now. Mm. And there's a paper that's in being published right at this moment about phthalates and impact on salmonids, and we are finding phthalates, and we're working with the Asset Lab, Dr. Kenish. I think John has probably been pretty instrumental, John Kenish, with Veronica too, but very concerned about all this for years. And so we have found phthalates in juvenile coho salmon, at significant levels of it, and Dolly Varden and things like that. What that all means, we don't know yet, and the papers are coming out here shortly. But I'm not the scientist in the group, so I know enough about it to be very, very scared.
You're an educated man, though.
I am.
So
I'm a well-educated garbage man.
And we'll get back to the garbage level of this. Veronica, is there anything you'd like to add?
Not at the moment. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about what we do. This, like I said in my email to you, this work is really close to my heart, and sharing the information that we're finding is, I think, a really important part of what we do, so that people are more aware of the impacts we have on the environment.
Yeah, I want to actually go on to this business of trying to get plastic out of your life, because it's something that I've been doing ever since the Gyre exhibition and finding it very, very difficult. And you're welcome to stay with us here, Veronica, but I know you have a prior engagement in a little bit, but just you can stay in the line as long as you like.
Right, and just to add, I'm actually going to a school to tell kids about how to reduce plastic in their lives, so I'm right on the same lines with you.
Well, okay, well, let me just pursue that a little bit. Because I'm really having trouble with this. You know, you can start when you go in a store and try and get stuff that's not packaged. You can start when you go into a restaurant and they insist on putting it into a clamshell. Or you go to the seafood people and they insist on putting it in plastic, and they say the health department makes them do it. I mean, it's driving me absolutely crazy. It takes forever to get the least little bit of progress on this.
Yeah, I agree. And you know, a lot of students have asked me, how do you go around and talk about this sort of stuff, and what changes do you make in your life? And it's really about compromise for me, because honestly, I can't be a citizen of the world and tell people about what I'm learning and be entirely free of plastic. There's just almost no way.
Yeah, your laboratory wouldn't be there.
Exactly. And so it's all about making small changes step by step and just being very self-aware and conscious. So for me, my first sorts of steps were starting to make my own food. So I bake my own bread, which doesn't seem impressive to other people, but when you're a graduate student, that's really impressive.
I'm impressed.
And you know, I started going to the farmer's market at the Sears Mall on Wednesdays, and there's a woman there who provides sort of fermented foods, because my biggest issue in terms of my diet has been yogurt. I love yogurt, but you can't recycle the plastic containers that the yogurt come in, because it's number 5 plastic. And so it was really hard for me to give it up in my diet, and all of a sudden I found this woman who sells fermented probiotic products, and she puts them in mason jars. And so a lot of it has to do with just being very conscious of what you purchase and who you're purchasing it from.
And being willing to go the extra mile in terms of maybe like returning the jars and all that sort of thing, and paying a bit more, maybe.
Right. And taking time to cook, you know, versus fast food all the time or something like that. Or, you know, frequenting restaurants that will use cardboard containers versus styrofoam or plastic containers. I try and just be loyal to the places that I know are sort of a little bit more environmentally conscious. And that's one of the things that I do. My other thing, and this is not a personal plug or anything like that, but what really drives me crazy is the hot lunches at the schools. And so what they do is they serve food that's in like a plastic container covered on a plastic wrap that they proceed to heat. And it's just very wasteful. And so my personal mission is to hopefully one day change that.
Veronica, thank you so much. Stay on the line if you wish. I want to pursue this a little bit more. Nicole, that probably everything that Veronica said about trying to reduce plastics, you would probably echo.
Certainly. One of the things we try to do in our STEM education outreach program, we work with the local Anne Arundel County Public School District, and we want the students to take charge of their education. How are these students going to understand the effect the single-use plastic has on the environment if they don't experience the marine environment? And so what we did was we created a problem-based learning activity where we co-authored a blog with them about the cause and effects of plastic pollution in the oceans as we crossed the Pacific Ocean. Hmm. And that was a really fun activity where they got to explore, you know, what can they do in their schools and at home to help alleviate this problem.
Yeah. Let's well, that's very constructive. And you brought up a key expression there, which is single use, because I think that's another, along with just trying to deconstruct what you're doing and where the plastic is and how it can be removed or reduced, there's also the situation of avoiding single use anything. Anything. Let's go to Kathy, joins the program in Craig, Alaska. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Kathy.
Yeah, thanks. This is Kathy Peavy down here in Craig.
Yeah, the legendary Kathy Peavy.
What's that?
You're legendary, aren't you?
Oh, I don't know. I kind of consider myself a queen of debris on the 4th of July during the parade, but
yeah.
That's about it.
Oh, okay. Queen of debris.
Anyway, well, you know, I'm really glad you're having this talk today. This is great. You know, rejuvenates the already known awareness of marine debris. But I had a couple of questions for Nicole. With Ocean Research, are you guys tied in with NOAA's marine debris program at all?
Well, Chris is.
I can't quite hear.
Okay, go ahead, Nicole.
Not directly. We would like to get more involved with their Mid-Atlantic work, specifically in the Chesapeake, when it comes to helping with prioritization of cleanup effort. Obviously, we don't have nearly the same severity of accumulation of debris as Alaska does. We only have about a quarter of the size, a quarter of the length of the shoreline that Alaska does. But the way we approach it now in the Chesapeake seems to be kind of piecemeal, and we would like to help out with that developing program.
Sure. Now, I've been up to the Alaska Forum on the Environment several years, and our crew was awarded the Outstanding Achievement Award in 2013. I'd like to throw that out there to my crew. But I understand you're going to be giving a presentation, and I was curious, what will you be talking about in Alaska that's going to be of importance to us? But, because to me, what I'm seeing is a lot of reinventing the wheel when we have, you know, we have all this knowledge already here. We were pretty much aware of what's going on with debris. You know, we've got NOAA's Marine Debris Program. We've got the Alaska Marine Stewardship Foundation that's going to be switching over to the Sitka Sound Science Center possibly. You know, the good works that Dave Gaudette has done, Palliser, all the contractors here in Alaska. So I just, you know, like listening to the young girl Veronica talk about the albatross, I mean, it's not new. I mean, we're quite aware of all of this. And to me, it's funding, and it seems to me to be like these groups, you guys all need to get together a little bit more to save on funding so that we can get funding to clean these beaches, because that's really, you know, a huge problem. And I don't think that anyone would disagree with me on that. But I feel like I'm hearing things that we have been hearing for a long time, but I just feel like people need to be more working together. And yeah.
Anyway, okay, I think we're all going to agree with that, Queen of Debris. Chris Palliser, you probably agree with that.
I hope so.
Yeah.
Well,
go ahead, Nicole. You jump right in there.
Sure. Well, what we're doing is we're presenting an opportunity to use another resource. So the Ocean Research Project has a sailing-based platform, and we combine that using some of the latest technologies, aerial and underwater, unmanned and autonomous equipment. And so it's more about sharing resources and capabilities. I recognize that Alaska, I think, has the spotlight on it for the biggest marine debris problems that are ongoing, and not just because of the tsunami event. But really, I think that a lot of what's going on in Alaska, it's kind of that the way that you've approached the problems the solutions and the challenges are still going to be pretty different than how stateside coastlines approach their situations, because the marine environment is very different, and you also have very different sources of marine pollution.
Kathy?
Thing I wanted to mention is, to me, I just still don't see a central location of somebody or an agency. You know, we've got people like Palliser, we've got me, the Science Center, we've got people all up and down the coast, numerous tribes, you know, doing marine debris cleanups, the Nature Conservancy getting funding for the tribes to do marine debris surveying and cleanup. But I need to see, where is that? Who is keeping track of all of this? And it seems like there's a lot of overlapping. And to me, I think those are issues that are really important for making sure that we're kind of on the same page.
Kathy, I want to thank you for your call. We need to take a break, and we'll check in with Chris Palliser, because I think there is some progress as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from this APRN member station.
Want to know more about how you and your family may get help buying health care coverage or avoid a tax penalty? Go to getcoveredak.org or call 211. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, a nonprofit health organization.
Alaska Pacific University offers the APU Promise Tuition Grant, a program designed to significantly minimize or eliminate out-of-pocket tuition expenses for Pell-eligible students. Deadline to apply is March 1, 2015. Alaska Pacific University is a private nonprofit offering small class sizes with a student-centered approach in the arts and sciences. More at 1-800-252-7528. This message is sponsored by APU.
Well, that was quite the challenge that came down from Kathy. She said, well, come on, isn't it time to start coordinating? Isn't there seeming to be some overlap here? And I guess, I'm no expert, but it seems to me that awareness is rapidly growing of this problem of plastic in the ocean. Not for somebody like Kathy, who's been collecting it and exhibiting it for years, but for many of the rest of us, not for Nicole and not for Chris, but for many people. There are so many other things to be concerned about, and suddenly, oh, yeah, and then there's this one. So for a number of people, I think there is a massive educational effort that needs to go on. But beyond that, Chris, I understand that it's now to the point where you've persisted enough in the gathering of the debris that you're actually to the point where you're going to be able to hoist it out, that funding has come through to actually hoist it out.
Yeah, but before I get to that, I'd like to make a couple points, and I have to agree 100% with Kathy. She made a really, really good point there, in that I believe our policymakers at least should know all about marine debris. I don't know how much more education at that level that we need to do. At the public level, maybe yes, keep control of your plastic. The other thing is the root cause of our major environmental problems right now, and I classify as marine debris as the second after global warming and all of its impacts, because the marine debris that is on the top of the ocean, it's on the bottom of the ocean, it's all the way through water column, it's in all the organisms top to bottom, and it's on all of our coastlines all around the world. It is a major, major problem. But all of these major problems, global warming, ocean acidification, and marine debris, come from the petroleum product industry, root. And we need a very significant carbon tax to capture this stuff, and we need to have bottle deposits and deposits on all plastic items. People, until they have to pay the real cost of stuff, are not going to quit using this. So it's okay. I think education's great, but I agree with Kathy. We have a problem. We know what the problem is, and now let's spend money on fixing it.
And it has to be hit in on the economic level.
It does, and everybody has to pay the price for their participation in this, and we're not. It's all subsidized, and it's all hidden, and people are not realizing the real cost of our affiliation with plastic, or addiction to plastic. So it's a bad deal. But On to the recovery project.
Get down to those beaches. Now, okay, forget about all the plastic that's going to come. How about the plastic you've already gathered up?
So the Japanese government very kindly gave the states $5 million to do marine debris, tsunami debris cleanup. And that's one thing I want to mention to Nicole. We've had a massive marine debris problem in Alaska long before the tsunami debris hit. I mean, that basically doubled our volume, but we've always had a really bad problem up here. And it's mostly Western Pacific drift that we're getting here. It's not local. But so we've been picking up a lot of debris, and we now have 1,800 super sacks sitting on the beaches and in storage yards and stuff, and we don't have any place here that'll take it anymore for one reason or another. So we're stuck, and we need to figure out a way to get this out of here. And that Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation just got some money from NOAA that actually came from the Japanese government to fund the removal of that debris that we have collected this summer. So
you can get it on a barge. What, how much again?
We have 1,800 super sacks and a lot of other loose debris. It's probably about pretty close to 3,000 cubic yards of plastic, and we expect to double that by mid-July of this year.
That's more than one barge.
Oh, it's a huge boat. It's a huge boat, and it's a lot of helicopter time. I mean, these beaches we're working on are extremely remote and dangerous and difficult to get on and off of, and we spend a huge amount of money. The easy part's collecting and consolidating. The hard part is getting it off the beach and getting it to a proper landfill center.
After talking to Gaudette, I'm very happy that you can use a helicopter, because this can be very, very dangerous trying to get to these shorelines.
Yeah, it is. And every year we get our small skiffs and stuff flipped. And, you know, it's a challenge, and it costs a lot of money. And we're exposed out there in the Gulf with our small vessels. This is underfunded, and it's undercapitalized. None of us have the right equipment for doing this work, and we use a lot of volunteer help. And I know Kathy's struggled for years with volunteers and stuff, and it's a very, very difficult, dangerous job for all of us. And now that we have some money, we can do this. It's not going to be enough money to do everything we want to do. We hope to get down there and work with the Sitka Sound Science Center and all the folks down in Southeast Alaska that are consolidating debris this summer. And hopefully this barge will just make a circuit around the Northern Gulf and go down to Southeast Alaska. And we're talking with our colleagues in British Columbia. They may join us too and take a big load of trash down to hopefully a recycling center in Seattle.
Recycling is somewhat relative in this case, though.
Yeah, it is. Most of this stuff is just junk, and there's not much value in it. So, you know, we may pay more to recycle than we can to landfill, which is tough to deal with.
And we get this one from Kevin by email. Has anybody made progress on making a non-toxic plastic substitute that will break down in a less harmful way? Nicole, I'm going to toss that in your direction.
Well, I'm going to have to pass on that one. Sorry.
Well, I know this much. Biodegradable plastic ain't. It just becomes microplastic.
Yeah, but the Virginia Institute of Marine Sciences, I think through College of William & Mary, just patented a new plastic that's made out of algae that's in the ocean. It's totally natural. It breaks down to totally natural products. And they're patenting that now, and they have high hopes for that. So there may be something in the future. They can grow it out of ocean water, and it goes right back to ocean. Then we can just throw it in the ocean.
and we're already drumming up the market right now, golly. Yeah. Nothing like talk radio for accelerating demand for products. Let's go to Jim in Equoc. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Jim.
Yeah, hello there. I know a lot of, NOAA, this problem was around in the late 80s and 90s, and that's why that PDQ program with Ted Stevens and Harvey and I sat down, because I spent a lot of time out there in the Barents, and I did 13 contracts. And, you know, the part of the problem was that, you know, then it was, you could throw trash overboard, and, you know, like, you have 200 people on these ships, and, you know, I almost got fired for not doing it. That's where I crafted a burn barrel on the Highland Light. I we were around by Togiak, and I fished there for herring before, and you have these big ships that carry 200 people, a lot of waste. You look at these villages, you think about all that plastic, but this is heavy duty plastic. That's 20, 30 years ago. So that stuff is breaking down. That's why you're seeing a lot of this. I'm not trying to point that total finger at the, you know, there's a good, the CDQ program did really good for the coastal villages, but the idea was to shut them up, and that's what Ted and High and Harvey, we did, but we didn't do the whole thing of, you know, you have all this waste, and, you know, you, even when you're, it used to be all bottom trawl, and, you know, you'd have pieces of poly on the bottom of the net, your money bag, and what had happened, some of them would rip off, so that's floating around and washing ashore in Togiak or anywhere along the coast, so you have this problem of, you know, of continual stuff going in like poly and plastic going into the ocean and breaking down. Now you're seeing this smaller plastic effort floats around a while. It's not, it's been there long before the Japanese tsunami. So, you know, I've addressed this a few times and I've been shut down pretty bad with, you know, especially, you know, talking about it and making people more aware. You know, we need to, you know, we need these dollars from these trawlers to clean up our ocean. No, that's where we need to go and see these big corporations.
Yeah, Jim, just take your CDQ dollars and shut up, Jim.
Well, we do, yeah, but I don't have a lot of say in the CDQ and shut up. I'm aware of the bycatch of kings come to our Nooshiak River that I'm afraid of. That's what's going on there. It's a no, you know, it's the halibut that the same people, the trawlers, so, you know, we're pointing the finger at all of them. But the thing is that we tried to address this in the late 80s and 90s already with this waste, you know.
Thanks, Jim, for that.
I must say that Senator Murkowski just recently was successful in getting $6 million put into the NOAA marine debris budget. And so that's a big step on the federal level. That's the biggest movement the feds have ever made to address this issue.
It also takes a little bit more enforcement with some of the other agencies. I know that they have been revising the MARPOL annex, the Marine and Pollution Prevention at sea over since the 70s. And finally, at this point, they have really reduced what can be considered garbage. And absolutely no plastic should go overseas, be dumped over. But it's going to take a lot of enforcement and regulation, and companies managing cargo ships and cruise ships and all kinds of ships and individuals to make sure that that doesn't happen.
Yeah, and once it gets out of sight, you know, out in the deeper ocean, nobody's watching.
In January 2012, a container ship lost 29 containers in northern Gulf of Alaska, and all that plastic that was in those containers is now spread along thousands of miles of shoreline. There's no enforcement at all.
And there's no accountability for the shipper, no accountability?
Yeah, they don't report. They do report. Nobody seems to know what's going on. There just doesn't seem to be anything going on with that. I mean, there's hundreds and hundreds of containers dumped in the ocean every year. So that's just another aspect of it, too.
Yeah.
Jim Inekwak, thanks for your call.
Okay, have a good day.
Thank you. Hey, you too. Wow, great to hear from Jim. Margo joins the program from Sitka. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Margo.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Sure.
So I work at the Sitka Sound Science Center down here in Sitka, and we've been working on marine debris cleanup since about 2008. We've removed, I think it's now about 120,000 pounds from beaches around here. And I just wanted to kind of call and throw in my two cents. I definitely agree with Chris and Kathy. There needs to be, you know, a lot more cooperation and more. It's going to take more money and harder work and a lot of efforts to kind of spread awareness and get that ball rolling. And it is a really daunting problem. I mean, it's huge and it's complicated and it's everywhere. And we've been seeing it for a long time. And so, you know, I think it's easy to get a little bit discouraged about issues like this that are on such a large scale. But on the flip side of that, one of the reasons I love working on marine debris cleanups and on outreach and education about this kind of stuff is it's really a problem that people can take individual action on. You know, it's easy for individuals to make, you know, lifestyle changes and make efforts to reduce, you know, their own contribution to marine debris and also to assist in cleanup efforts. And I think that's one of the reasons it's so great to do outreach and education about stuff like this, because it's something that people can take ownership of and can feel like they're really making a difference.
Well, I don't know. I'm with Chris on this. I really am, because I've made a whole lot of little lifestyle changes, and I can't do anything about the vendors and the overpackaging and the endless amounts of this stuff that's being manufactured over in China, any of that. I think it takes something at the economic level to really be effective. I'm coming around to that, Margo, I got to say.
Yeah, I mean, I do agree with you. It's going to take huge changes, and it's going to take, lawmakers getting educated and realizing that this is a priority and making those huge, broad decisions and dedicating money and time and resources to this. But I guess, you know, I do a lot of outreach in Sitka and in the schools and with the community. And I feel like we've been really lucky in that people in Alaska really understand why this is important, and they, they're passionate about trying to solve the problem and to, you know, make changes in the way that they, you know, rely on plastic and things like that. So I think that, both are true. And, it's just important to remember that even though sometimes these problems seem so overwhelming and like they won't be solved, there is a huge community of people who are really passionate about, you know, fixing the problem.
Yeah, I guess. And when their numbers mass up and it starts to actually be persuasive to the vendors and the purchasers and so forth, and they start to pursue it back, you know, back pressure up the supply lines. I'm not discounting any of that at all, Margo.
It's inspirational
to know that you're making progress. It always is.
And I think that we have seen some changes. You know, California has banned plastic bags, and states have banned, microbeads, products containing microplastics, to try and reduce that sort of direct contribution. And I find those things really encouraging. I think that's, you know, a sign that people are taking this seriously and are talking about it, and that will continue to spread.
Go ahead, Chris Palliser.
The tough thing about Alaska is we don't follow the national norm in that 90-some percent of our, probably 99% of our debris comes from outside sources. They're not land-based sources. So it's not what people in Sitka or Homer or Seward are doing that are trashing our beaches. It's foreign countries and foreign fishing fleets and stuff like that. So it's going to be really hard to change that in Alaska, and education is great, but I still believe ultimately we need top-down federal and international laws that stick us somehow, and that's how we ultimately cleaned up our water and cleaned up our air. So I think that's probably what's going to have to happen at some point.
That's Chris Palliser, the president of Gulf of Alaska Keeper, as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from this APRN member station. If you're ready to quit tobacco, Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online. Now introducing Text to Quit, a way to help you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse, all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now or visit alaskaquitline.com for more information. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
Want to know more about how you and your family may get help buying health care coverage or avoid a tax penalty? Go to getcoveredak.org or call 211. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, a nonprofit health organization.
Well, I don't know when we've had a more information-packed program, and maybe I don't know when we've had a more depressing one. It's Talk of Alaska. We're talking about plastic in the ocean. We have highly qualified panelists. Nicole Trenholm of Ocean Research Project coming to Alaska for a keynote speech at the Alaska Forum on the Environment. You're really getting an earful today. I just wanted to give you the floor a little bit to respond.
Sure. Well, you know, we're pointing fingers at a lot of the different problems causing the marine debris issue. But we got to also take a look at the producers of plastic products and the transporters of plastic products. They really need to step up their game and take responsibility for the life of their products. And No, that's something I feel pretty strongly about. You know, besides, you know, the individual who can make better personal decisions on, you know, how they manage and use the products that, you know, the single, you know, and hopefully they won't use single use products. They'll start to phase that out of their lives. I try every day to make better decisions and skip out on single use materials and. It certainly is a challenge, but when you walk into, for us it's Wawa on the East Coast, and you want to get a coffee in the morning, bring your own stainless steel container. You know, forget, you know, don't use the little plastic straw sticks. You know, you can, and other people see you doing that. The cash registers, they are always confused when they see you try to ring up. I'm like, it's a 20 ounce, you know.
Yeah.
Just give me, you know, I'll pay for a large. It's fine.
Well, I'm just thinking of Arlo Guthrie said, you know, if one person marches into the draft board and sings you can get anything you want at Alice's restaurant, they'll think he's crazy. But if you get 100 of them, they know it's a movement.
Yeah.
Then they'll hire new checkout people. So I had a nervous breakdown, cognitive dissonance. Okay, getting giddy here. Let's go to John, joins the program from Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, John.
Hi, how you doing?
Pretty good.
I'm John Kennish, the person who's done a lot of the analysis on these phthalates that are present in the marine environment.
Oh, yes, you worked with Veronica on that paper, Effects of Marine Debris, that we were talking about.
Yeah, and actually with Chris and with another professor from the school of down in Virginia, who's...
William and Mary.
Patty Swallow. But anyway, I just wanted to mention that the levels of phthalates is probably somewhere around 300 or 400 parts per billion, because we measured them in two different types of clams, and they're usually known not to metabolize. So the levels are significant in terms of contamination, and it's globally because you could see it in different locations through in the marine environment here in Alaska. We saw it in halibut and salmon as well.
You're saying it's background at this point in biological systems?
There's no question about it being background level, but no one ever wants to talk about that. The other problem is, of course, that the particles are wider range than what's been described here. Yeah, you do have large plastic debris, but you also have microplastics, and you also have nanoplastics. Nanoplastics are used in detergents and in women's... materials that they put on their faces and stuff, and hair washes and stuff. And in fact, in New York State, they've tried to ban those materials because those particles actually, they're so small, they intercalate directly into the cells, and they've measured them in fish tissue and fish brains and stuff like that. So the problem is a global one, and people need to be aware of this, that they're not only are they using this being exposed indirectly, they're also being exposed directly in their food. And realistically, people need to actually... make a statement publicly that this stuff needs to be removed on all levels because it's or has to be changed in terms of composition. You remember what happened with the global impact of ozone, right? Years ago, when people started to really do something about it, the chemical companies actually changed their methods of producing products that would work and it eliminated those ozone disruptors. So there's no reason why it can't happen with plastics as well. But the people have to speak up and push this system. The government's not very good at responding, unfortunately, until the public raises a hue and cry about it.
Thank you, John, the man with the lab.
Yeah.
The man with the lab. Do you get to be in the new building over there at the university?
Gary, when you actually look at the numbers, to tell you the truth, something definitely needs to be done.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you, John.
Yep.
It's Talk of Alaska. We're talking about plastic in the ocean. We have Chris Ballister of Gulf Alaska Keeper with us. We have Nicole Trenholm of the Ocean Research Project, who will be giving a keynote speech at the Alaska Forum next Monday at lunchtime. And Terry joins the program from Valdez. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Terry.
Yeah, I've been beachcombing the Egg Island groups off of Cordova for the last 30 years, and there used to be a lot more garbage coming up on the beaches back then when fishing boats could dump it right over the side. And the cruise ship fleets, there was a lot more plastic. What I've always done when I'm camping out there anyway, it's fun to have a bonfire at night, and I would just police up as much as I could and just burn it.
Put it in the air.
I don't see any harm in doing that.
It's really, really nasty stuff, and you shouldn't burn it.
Oh, I think hauling it to a landfill, you look at the carbon footprint of doing it your way, I just don't see it.
Well, you know, the EPA won't let you burn that stuff for reasons.
Yeah, Terry, I'm absolutely loving this old school, new school discussion, but I know we're not going to get anywhere.
The other thing I wanted to bring up on that was comparing it to the Exxon Valdez oil spill. I find that just laughable. You know, I worked that, and the amount of plastics coming up on the beaches are far less than they were even 20 years ago. So anyway, I applaud your efforts, and I encourage people that do go camping out, clean it up and burn it. Burn it down on the tide marked where the
we are not endorsing it.
Tide washes it.
We're not going to endorse that one, Terry. I can see that right now.
Yep.
Okay, Chris.
Well, I encourage people just to ignore that anyway. And
thank
that.
You. We got about
a problem. Anyway.
Thanks, Terry. Yeah, thanks. Okay, Chris. Chris and Nicole, you got the last words, and it's only a minute and a half.
That burning that plastic, that stuff's very toxic,
yeah.
And there's a lot of reasons why you shouldn't burn it.
Yeah.
I applaud Terry for picking the stuff up. You know, if you're going to go out there and pick a bunch of that stuff up, consolidate it, and let us know where it is, and we'll pick it up for you.
All right. Gulf of Alaska Keeper. Go ahead,
yeah.
Nicole.
So just parting words here. We need to reduce it and keep it from getting in the marine environment so we don't have to clean it up and so nobody burns it.
Hmm. So what do you see with your submersibles? That really fascinated me there.
Well, I'm thinking more submersibles. We have a ghost pot problem in the Chesapeake Bay.
Hmm.
And using sonars and using like ROVs, that really helps with the detection of where these things are. About 20% of the crab pots used annually end up abandoned and accumulating on the Chesapeake Bay
We've got ghost pots in the Bering too.
Right.
And around Kodiak.
Yeah, so we're not alone.
So, yeah. Another problem.
Well, I hope you enjoy your trip to Alaska, Nicole.
Thank you.
All right, Chris.
One other thing, we have a monitoring project and which we've been doing for 8 years, and there's a lot of debris coming up on our beaches.
Time's up. Thanks to Dave Waldron. Thanks to National Public Radio. Josh Edge.
Talk
I'm Steve Feimel.
Is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly. Enroll now in the Health Insurance Marketplace. Sign up at healthcare.gov. Open enrollment ends February 15th. Depending on your income, age, and family size, you may be eligible for discounts that may lower your monthly costs and out-of-pocket expenses. Pick a plan that is right for you and your family. Call 211 for free individual assistance about the Health Insurance Marketplace. Visit getcoveredalaska.org for more information. This message sponsored by Ashna, a partner of Get Covered Alaska.
Alaska Pacific University now offers the APU Promise Tuition Grant, a program designed to significantly minimize or eliminate out-of-pocket tuition expenses for Pell-eligible students. More at 1-800-272-7528. This message is sponsored by APU.
This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.